Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome back to the Early Morning Sunday Show. And it is time now for us to speak with Mufti Mohammed Hafiji. He is from the Economics and Finance Desk of the Jamaatul Ulema South Africa, and it is our Conscious Consumer slot. So inshallah, we will be speaking to him right now. And let us first welcome him. Assalamu alaikum, Mufti, and welcome to the Conscious Consumer slot, which we look forward to every Sunday morning.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. To yourself and to all our listeners, and Jazakallah for having me once again.
All right, we're looking at some interesting thing today. There's one that I have a lot to say about when we come to it, inshallah. But we're starting off with, maybe you can give us a quick rundown or a quick update on the events that took place last week. I think we did speak to you a little bit about it. And I think we'd like to find out also, you know, how did the series go, the Tijara series, that, you know, if you could give us a quick brief on that.
Okay, sure. Look, thus far we've completed a total of three programs of the six lectures within the Tijara series. Last Friday, we hosted our community of Kamelfe West and Crosby, hosted our Sheikh and Mulana Suleiman Mullah, who provided a riveting lecture and a very educational experience for one and all. I think the most interesting part about the whole event was that for a change, we saw the entire community, young, old, men, women, coming together within an Islamic context, you know, and surrounding, coming together on the basis of learning and teaching, and more specifically with regard to the aspect of empowering ourselves regarding the rules of trade and commerce. So over the last, in fact, in the last Friday, he discussed the aspect to address the issue of whether it is possible for a Muslim male or female to trade and at the same time be honest. During the segment, there was a really deep insight into some of the aspects of Quran and the Sunnah of Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. The most striking aspect is that we find that in the case of this particular speaker, verses of the Quran and the Sunnah of Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam are contemporized and given a new, or rather a relevant meaning for that we can relate to. And not to say that others cannot do it, but it's just so refreshing and so enlightening to note that we have a Quran and a Sunnah which is so relevant in this day and age. Mm-hmm. And here you have a scholar unpacking it for us and giving it to us on the plate. Surprisingly, you know, we had youth in our audience who put aside their football for the evening. You know, football for youth or for anyone middle age is like a huge sacrifice for the night. Many young people of that nature came to the and attended the event and benefited tremendously from the knowledge which Allah Ta'ala has bestowed upon Mulana Suleiman Mullah. The recordings of the lectures, this particular one is already available on Mulana Suleiman's YouTube channel. And I would implore one and all to access that channel and listen to the talk for deeper insight into the topic that was discussed last Friday.
Okay, inshallah, I'm sure that that would make very good listening to, as you said. It'll be interesting and I'm sure a huge learning for us as well. So we'll try and do that and we've listen got, to it. I'm sure got, it would be good.
Sorry for that. We've got three events lined up. We've got this coming Friday. Mufti Umair Qutail will be addressing the aspect of the what and why of Islamic banking, where many individuals, small business, may want to access some funding within an Islamic framework. And Mufti Umair will be addressing that particular angle of finance this Friday, inshallah. And then on Saturday afternoon, between 2 and 4 p.m., Sister Khadija Pochi will be addressing our mothers and sisters, providing some inspiration to initiate a small business enterprise and to get it going, despite the challenges and hurdles which may be encountered on the path.
That, I'm sure, will be pretty interesting as well as quite a bit of information to be gathered and garnered from there to use, especially for women who are looking to start this kind of thing from home.
Yes, definitely. And here you have an example of someone who is doing it hands-on, you know, like a good few, I would say, about at least two decades now running the Muslim Women magazine. So we hope and pray to Allah Ta'ala that He accept it and make it a means of inspiration for many other young Muslimas to engage in it, in trade and commerce in a dignified Islamic setting, inshallah.
Inshallah. All right, so we can move on to some of the topics that we are discussing today, and one of them is the being more vigilant when withdrawing money at supermarkets. I know we should be vigilant all the time, but why supermarkets in particular?
Very good question. The thing is, if you look at the number of channels through which ordinary consumers can access their funds which are lodged at a bank, you obviously have a branch withdrawal, which is probably the most expensive, and then you have the ATM withdrawal, which is relatively cheaper, and then you have accessing your funds at a supermarket teller, which is, as far as I understand, the most cheapest way to access cash in your, from your bank account, and it is a mutual benefit in the sense that the supermarket gets rid of cash on hand and has to deposit less, because remember, handling of cash on their end is also a risk, and also carries additional costs when it comes to movement of that money from one place to another. And then there's also a benefit for the consumer in the sense that in a cheap, effective way, together with getting your groceries, you access your cash and you get something to carry you through for a few more days. So this is why the aspect of supermarket withdrawing of cash at the supermarket becomes relevant. But to answer your question on why more vigilance is required, we find a recent phenomena where tellers themselves, some of them are very, very desperate. And what tends to happen is throughout the process of passing all your scanning, all your merchandise that you purchased, you also make your request for, let's say, just as an example of 1,000 rand. So in the day of that employee's work, for say from 8 o'clock in the morning to about 5 p.m. in the evening or late afternoon, that person is encountering a host of customers who would be making withdrawals. So in the process, what tends to happen and what can happen is that they see it as an opportunity to exploit and actually siphon money away from the customer. So what they do is, let's say you requested 1,000 rand. They would make an entry for 1,020 rand. So it's 1020, and it's hardly noticeable. So when they access the money, you get your 1,000 rand, but the 20 rand is taken away by the supermarket teller. So what will happen now is on the back end of the supermarket, it's picked up as if the customer withdrew 1,020 rand. It's not detected that there was actually theft in the process. So that is very much up to the customer to be vigilant, look at that receipt, make sure that the amount you requested is reflected on the receipt and you receive the very same amount. So it can happen. I'm not saying it happens every day. I don't have exact statistics on that. But there are cases reported in this very week where a person withdrew money and the supermarket teller sees it as an opportunity to siphon money, entered a slightly inflated amount and kept a portion for themselves, and the actual amount that the customer requested was granted to the customer.
All right, yeah, I think that's something most of us don't do when we don't look at our cash sales slips and we come out the supermarket, and sometimes they are mistakes, unconsciously by them, but also things like this can happen, and I think you're quite right, we should be more vigilant in what we're doing or how we check our slips in particular, just as we would with our bank statements.
Yes, definitely. What tends to happen is as a consumer, you requested 1,000 rand, so you request 1,000 rand, you count the cash. But you don't check whether there's a correlation between the cash in your hand versus the receipt printout.
No, absolutely. All right. And then we're looking now, and like I said, this for me is really an important one. I worked in the service industry and trained in customer relations. So when I come across this, and not necessarily only with the subject we're discussing, but just customer service in basic, it really irks me sometimes when things don't go the way I think they should be going. So we're looking at frontline staff and where many businesses fail, and you're quite right about that, I think. So tell us a little bit about why you brought this up.
I think I'm looking forward to your input that will be made, inshallah. Basically, when you look at businesses, large and small, you find that many a time businesses tend to focus on the bigger stuff like, the customer strategy and or customer relations. They talk about, I want to play on the word strategy specifically. Sometimes I think that the only thing strategic in the word strategy is many institutions just look at the word and they think they're doing something really great, but if you really analyze what's happening, it's very basic, very based kind of things, you know. So anyway, many a time you find these large and small businesses tend to focus on bigger things, but don't focus on the all-important part about rearing and training frontline staff to manage customers. Mm-hmm. Because trust me, and I'm sure you'll concur with me on this here, the frontline staff experience can be make it or break it for a customer.
Absolutely.
A customer can simply have one or two occurrences which are negative and unpleasant, unsavory with frontline staff, and simply turn away from a supermarket or any other store. So I just want to maybe see a few examples. And then I don't want to create an impression that this only happens in supermarkets. It can even happen in a small business where you have one employee who manages your till or whatever it is, you know. Just that one employee can mess up and do excessive harm to a business. So when you think about the frontline staff experience, things like, you know, how does your frontline staff communicate to a customer that the transaction using their card has been declined? How do they say it? It's something that can turn a person off. How they, let's say, example, you're purchasing some items and maybe something is broken or damaged and someone from the staff has to go and bring it for you and replace it before you finalize your purchase. The kind of body language that comes across when they have to do that, or even remarks that they make about your purchases that have been made. These are just, I'm just using three examples. I'm going to expect more from you since you've got the training and experience in this regard, but I just want to make the point that whether the business is a small or a big business, it is so extremely crucial to focus on the training and rearing of your frontline staff. Ultimately, it's not only for your own benefit, you are also empowering, as a small business owner or large business, you're actually empowering someone who will hopefully one day start out on their own and realize the importance of the skills that have been imparted to them while under your employee. You know, so it's important. It's not only for your own benefit. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, in the long run, you don't want to have these people dependent on you as an employer for as long as they live. You want to see them eventually feed themselves and fend for themselves. So the skills will eventually carry them into the future in a more favorable manner.
I think, you know, for me, when we speak about frontline staff, it doesn't matter what business it is and how big or small that business is, but that person is your first point of contact. And if that person spoils the customer experience, I think a lot of the times you find people won't say anything, a lot of the times because people don't like confrontation or they just don't like conflict. So they walk away and they would never come back.
Never.
But instead, they could take that experience to others. And you'll find that word of mouth is the best advertisement, as they say. Mm-hmm. And you'll be surprised at how many clients and customers people lose because of that. And they don't even know it. I think I will tell you about a recent incident I had with a very major bank where I called through. I opened an account with them recently for business purposes. And when I called through, the person who opened the account for me, the consultant, had given me incorrect information, which I hadn't realized until 8 months down the line. When I called to access that account, I was basically shoved from pillar to post by several contact center agents. Being, you know, full-time at work, you don't always give it your 100%. When you speak to these people, you take for granted that they're helping you. But the apathy and the lack of knowledge that came through from all of these people I spoke to until eventually I got to one person who I really had to congratulate her because I was so angry by the time I got to her that she could hear it in my voice and my choice of words. And I think, you know, she immediately understood that I was fed up and she took it upon herself to try and you know, make the experience better for me. And had she not done that, I was on the verge of closing my account with them. So that alone will tell you.
As you say, that word of mouth, it's not only one customer who will be lost in the process. It's a whole string of customers because that person is a member of a family unit. And then that family unit gets the information about what the experience was about. And suddenly, when they all turn away gradually from the particular store or supermarket or whatever it is, As I said earlier on, I don't want to create the impression that this, what we're talking about only applies to supermarkets. It applies to ordinary vendors, ordinary service providers.
Yes.
I mean, I talk of a recent example where someone was consulting with a medical professional. I mean, it's a one-on-one engaging of service.
Yes.
But during the conversation, during the consult, the professional person is looking at their mobile phone, you know? And not realizing that you're actually being compensated for the time you're charging your client or your patient, whatever it is, and that person's attention is totally distracted more towards the mobile device rather than giving the customer the full attention and that they deserve.
Yeah, and it almost makes the person feel as if they're not really, you know, important enough for this person to be giving their time to. So you won't go back. You have that experience sometimes in restaurants as well, where your waiter or waitress would be, you know, really rude, don't pay attention. It also happens in the mom and pop stores that you may go to, the little corner cafes and things like that, where the owner is actually the person that you come into contact with. And they have this, like, you know, I'm an established business and I don't care. So if you, whether you come or go, and sometimes you actually hear people say that, I don't care if you go, you know, I don't need your business. I've got others. But that one incident could actually leave a bad taste in that person's mouth and the customers who are in the store at that time. And like you said, you know, it becomes almost like a domino effect. Everybody starts talking and it just your business is absolutely affected by it. And in larger businesses, I think a lot of the times many people forget that their internal customer is just as important as the external.
Definitely. You know, what's often ignored is the cause of this kind of behavior of staff, frontline staff. I would start off by saying that the cause of it all stems from the globalization movement, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And number two is the whole issue of consumer behavior. And what I'm referring to here is, if you recall, not that many decades ago, there was a time when stores would be shut for the whole weekend, or at least half of Saturday and the remaining of Sunday, right? Everyone was closed. If you needed milk or bread, you needed to get it before the stores closed for the weekend, and the next day you get your groceries will be on Monday. Now, that's just the way things work. Globalization and consumer behavior are two conceptual aspects which have eaten away the fabric of society. So what's basically happening now is, no matter how good frontline staff training you have, no matter how conducive those training programs may be, but if work conditions in general is not remedied, you'll find that even with the best of training, staff will not perform. They will not reflect a good customer experience and provide a good customer experience. So these are core fundamental issues, conceptual elements which are eating away the fabric of society. So as I say, even if wages are not conducive for the person, or overall consumer behavior is something which drives the person to behave in a specific way, then you find that even with the best of training, your frontline staff will let you down and they will not provide a favorable customer experience. So these are things to
Absolutely.
Keep in mind.
Absolutely. Yes, you're quite right with that. I mean, you know, when we look at the long hours some of these staff work in retail positions, especially now that we open an entire weekend, sometimes stores are open for almost 14 hours a day, and staff work really long periods of time. And I think, you know, businesses feel that they are saving when they make their staff work those long periods instead of maybe getting a double shift and getting two people to do the same job. You know, but you see it in the body language, as you said, you know, the drooped shoulders, the don't care attitude. Even when people answer phones, you know, it comes across. And
you can almost.
And I know one of the things that when I first worked in a call center when I was in school, I was taught that put a mirror in front of you and look into it when you speak and smile, because you can hear the smile over the phone, even if you're not feeling that way. And it's amazing. You know, I thought it was really, you know, people just trying to make us work harder, but it actually works, because when you see yourself smile, you automatically feel happier.
mean,
no, it's just subconscious. Yes, it's a subconscious thing, and a lot of the times, and you also find that because as frontline staff don't have kind of a relationship with their customers today, because like you said, customer behavior, people just go in to buy things. There's no longer that you know, I know this person. You know, you don't know your customer on a personal level, so you have to be friendly to get to know them, to make them feel important, to make them feel welcome. And those things don't come up anymore. It's just like, you know, you pay for your stuff and you leave. There's no more the greeting, the friendly smile, the welcome to our store, thank you for coming, that kind of thing. And it does make a customer feel wanted and appreciated.
Yes, definitely. And as we're saying, while in the past few minutes, we focused on the duty of the frontline staff to give a favorable experience to customers, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But there's a commensurate responsibility on the customer. As you mentioned, David, they also need to maybe simple things like passing a favorable remark, complimenting the person
yes.
for their work if something is good. That small connection from human to human is what differentiates our ability to surpass machine in overtaking our jobs.
Yes, absolutely. I'll give you a quick example, Mufti. I think about 2 days ago, a new hotel here in Durban, they had a staff member, I think one of their waiters, he got a tip of 5,000 rands. Now, this is highly unusual, but he gave a service that I think the person who gave him the tip must have really, really been blown away.
Mm.
But he didn't keep that 5,000 rand for himself because he saw it as a team effort and he shared it amongst the rest of his colleagues. That tells you how appreciated and how well the staff are being looked after, not only by the customer, the client of the business, but also by the people who run the management in that particular business, because only a happy staff member would do something like that.
Yes, sure. I often think, and I look at your example there, and I think that even if a customer cannot match that form
that
of
amount,
right,
yeah.
The ultimate form of miserliness is not to be able to even say a good word.
Yes.
So even if a customer cannot give cash or a material item, you know, value, the minimum you can do, the least one can do is a good word to motivate these frontline people that we come into contact with on a regular
mm-hmm.
basis.
Yeah, because you never know their you know, situations at that time. They could be smiling at you and doing their best, but inside what they're going through maybe, I mean, everybody walks around with that kind of situation. You know, we smile, but the world never knows what is happening in your mind at that time. And a pat on the back or a well done or a nice thank you can mean the world to them. It can actually, you know, take them a step away from, you'll be surprised, sometimes even suicide or depression or something like that, because they just feel appreciated at that moment. But that's very true. I think we underestimate and underappreciate people a lot.
Yeah.
All right, I could go on that subject. I think you can hear it from me. It's something that's a pet project with me. I meet a lot of people, you know, in where I live and in the work that people do there. So I get to speak to a lot of staff that work within those situations, and I understand exactly where they're coming from. And having trained and worked in that kind of situation, I also understand how important it is for them to be happy staff, and also, you know, coming from good backgrounds and understanding the work and also appreciating what they do in, you know, making the business better, because at the end of the day, a business that's faring well will mean better salaries for their staff as well.
Yes. There's a knock-on effect, as you say.
If
there's a knock-on effect from the good behavior of services of your staff, it could reflect in the bottom line eventually, and overall performance of business together with being able to compensate staff better is all the positives that come out of this kind of approach to doing business. I think what will help us is if we repeatedly bring up these things to remind ourselves and our listeners,
mm-hmm.
That's when we start seeing effects. So our listeners should be ready to listen to more about this same topic in time to come.
Yeah. Also, you know, when you think about it from an Islamic perspective, sometimes, you know, you're so focused on just paying and leaving that you may forget that it's your character that also says a lot. So when you smile or, you know, you're good to people and you're really thankful to people and show your gratitude, you're affecting that person with Islam. You're showing them that this is the way of the Muslim, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. So you also kind of, you know, you're giving da'wah without realizing it as well.
I think one of the core objectives of ideals that we're trying to advance in the Tijara series is that the core purpose of trade and commerce in Islam is to display exemplary conduct. Because
yes.
If you look at every other form of worship, whether it's your zakah, your salah, your hajj, it's all carried out within your own kind and people who are familiar with what you're doing. The only opportunity you have to impress on the significant other is through your commercial dealing. So
yes.
If your commercial dealings are done with the correct etiquette and frame of mind, adherence to the dictates of Quran and Sunnah, you'll find that it becomes an element of or catalyst towards others being impressed, the significant other being impressed and driven towards Islam. So that is basically one of the core values we're trying to drive through using the Tijara series platform.
I think that's an exceptional way of teaching it, because it's really something that we should be using on a daily basis, seeing that we trade and commerce is so important in our lives.
Yes, whether it's your purchase of daily bread or liter of milk, it's everything that carries a message of Islam, and that's as you alluded to early on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right, let's move on to considerations when a home loan is settled. What should we be taking into consideration?
Look, before I mention anything, I think I just want to make two points as a clarification. The first one is not actually a point relating to what I need to say, but I just hope that many, many individuals one day enjoy the privilege of being able to pay off a home loan of their own.
Inshallah.
But anyway, a home of your own, not a home loan.
Yeah.
If it's possible without a loan, by all means. But the thing is, I want to confine my discussion to the usage of Islamic financial institutions if one has to purchase a home using a financing arrangement. Basically, when a person pays off their loan, or even in the Islamic context, it would not be a loan. Let me put it that way. In the Islamic context, it would actually be a purchase of the asset, because the underlying asset is the transaction base. It's not just a loan where you got money from a bank and you're paying back money. That would be ultimate riba. This is now, in the case of an Islamic financial institution, it's the asset that you're buying from the bank. It's like going to a supermarket and buying a liter of milk. In this case, you're buying your house from a bank itself. So I won't go into the deeper underpinnings of that, but be that as it may, when that home loan is settled, there are basically two options available to any consumer, any ordinary person who's paid off that loan, that asset, right? Either that approved amount or the bond, call it the bond, is kept open as a line of credit, or it is cancelled, right? Now,
okay.
What some people tend to do is, and many people who are in the high end of business and so forth, they keep the bond open, because the bond is basically a legal agreement with a deed office which allows, it basically secures the interest of the financial institution that they have provided this amount of cash or whatever, and they have a right over the asset which is underlying that transaction. So basically, the two options are either you keep it open as a line of credit because it's pre-approved and you can always access it at a later stage, or you can cancel the bond arrangement. Now, I just want to highlight in each of these two options what would an ordinary consumer be up against. And I'm obviously keeping in mind that ordinary consumer who can only afford one house in his or her whole lifetime. I'm not referring to the high-end bracket of high-net-worth individuals. So let's assume a person decides, you know what, I paid off my loan, but whatever this bond that I have registered with the deeds office, I'm keeping it open as a line of credit. Now, what will typically happen is that the financial institution will keep the title deed of the property. In keeping it open as a line of credit, the first thing that they will do is they will keep the title deed of the property in their possession. As a consumer, you will not have that possession of the title deed. One has got to consider whether you want it or you don't want it, right?
Okay.
The second important aspect is to consider that there is a possibility, and this has happened with large financial institutions, where you decide to keep it as a line of credit open, and they keep your title deed, but the day you decide to cancel and cancel that bond, your title deed is lost, and no one can find it. Even large, sophisticated institutions have difficulty and have had cases where title deeds of ordinary clients have been lost, and that is a nightmare to replace. It can be a nightmare to replace. So that's the second aspect. The third aspect to keep in mind, if a person decides to keep the bond open as a line of credit, then there would be fees. And those fees, the day you decide to cancel, the fee could today be 2,000, for example, to cancel. But if you decide to keep it as a line of credit for another 5 years, in 5 years' time, the fee to cancel could be more. And it could go from 2,000 to 5,000, for example. So that's the third consideration. If a person is deciding to keep it open, keep the bond open as a line of credit to access at any point in time. However, if on the second option, if a person pays off their home, they acquire the asset now, and they want to cancel the bond, which is, I would say, the best option for an ordinary consumer who is not going to access any credit or any debt in the future. In this case, the first thing to keep in mind is it would be important to give at least a 90-day notice to the financial institution that you are cancelling your bond and you don't want to access it anymore. And so 90-day notice would be required. In this case, the financial institution will then assist you with cancellation. It will involve providing final settlement figures, as well as a consultation with bond cancellation attorney. Now, remember that the bond needs to be cancelled at the deed office, as I said early on. So if you are cancelling the bond, your attorney will work out with the bank to return your title deed to you, and attorney fees will apply to terminate that bond, because there's an intermediary between yourself and the deed office, and that intermediary is the lawyer. The attorneys will levy fees for cancellation of a bond. So those are the two options to consider when a home is a home loan or Islamic financial institution funding is terminated or coming to an end. It's either keeping it open as a line of credit, there are ramifications as I discuss, or considerations to be made, and then if you cancel it, there are also considerations.
You know, for someone who hasn't bought a house yet, I must say that there's so much to be taken into consideration that this is something you wouldn't, that comes to mind like an obvious thing. And I'm glad that you actually brought it up, especially there are many young people out there who've maybe just married or, you know, coming into money and are wanting to buy homes and things like that as an asset, or even building towards their future. And I think maybe when, like, you know, we say with our marriages, make a list of questions you'd like to ask the person that you're proposing marriage to, then the same should be done when you're doing home loans and things like that. You know, when you know there's large sums of money that's going to affect your life style. I think it's good to maybe put down a list of things by speaking to people in the know like yourself and others who would be able to actually give that kind of thing.
Yes. As I said, it's very relevant. I mean, those questions need to be clarified. If those questions can be clarified upfront, all the better, before any relationship is commenced with. Worst case scenario, if you, before making the actual decision of buying a house, it pays to maybe consult someone and get advice on the whole picture or do some basic research on the whole issue. It will be empowering and a definite learning curve that one could share with others so that they can avoid the pitfalls of some of these important considerations of acquiring an asset such as a home.
Okay, and let's move on to the last one, Mufti, and that's understand inflation to beat it. Please tell us about that. I think everybody, you know, feels when the word inflation comes up, it inflates our pressure a lot. So we need to know how we can do this.
Yes, I emphasize, as you mentioned, there's a need to understand it in order to beat it. That's what's important. And when it comes to inflation, I always like to summarize it by saying that in economics, there's a very big difference between inflation versus expected inflation. There's a very big difference there, because what tends to happen, the difference is as simple as this. Let's say there's a talk of fuel prices going up next month, and we're currently only in the middle of this month. We're currently in the middle of October, and there's only talk of fuel prices going up in November.
Right? Yeah.
This is now what will result in expected inflation. So although inflation is only going to happen in November, you'll find that prices will already start increasing. The price of milk, bread, basic commodities will already start increasing from now, right? And then when the actual inflation, when the actual price does take place, the increase does take place, you'll find that whoever is selling those items or merchandise, the price will be hiked again. So inflation will actually be worse. Expected inflation is worse than actual inflation. That's basically what it means.
Okay.
So if you notice, this particular phenomenon manifests itself in the South African case of healthcare. In South Africa specifically, you'll find that before any kind of market movements in terms of price increases and so forth, you'll find healthcare will be private healthcare will be the most significantly impacted industry. So your monthly premiums or whatever you're paying to have some healthcare cover will increase by almost double what the actual inflation is. If actual inflation is, let's use a simple example, 3%, mm-hmm. you'll find your healthcare cover payments will move by 6%. That's just one example of, in the South African case, what tends to happen to inflation versus expected inflation. In this week, I was reading a blog post in which the author made a comparison between prices today and what we will pay in 2050. Right? Mm-hmm. The comparison related to 12 items, just 12 items in South Africa and the same 12 items in the U.S. Right? And what this author did was basically worked out what these 12 items will cost in South Africa today versus what these very same 12 items will cost in 2050. He did this example for South Africa as well as the USA. You would be surprised and shocked to note that when he did the simulation, the price of bread today is currently roughly 12 rand, give and take, right?
Yeah.
In 2050, after simulating the effect of inflation and expected inflation, simulation is basically an econometric technique which we use,
yeah.
But it's not rocket science. In 2050, we should be paying almost 80 rand for a loaf of bread.
Wow. And that's South Africa.
That's South Africa. In the U.S., currently a loaf of bread is $1.92. In 2050, it is likely to cost $5.40. So it doesn't seem large, but in the U.S. case, it is massive. It's huge.
Massive, yes.
It's massive. I think I don't want to go into the 12 items. Oh, let me put it this way, right? Just to sum it up, right? The total bill of these 12 items, you look at low-fat yogurt, fresh bread, rooibos tea, rolled oats, avocado, sugar, bananas, coffee, chicken, milk and bread, right? So
it's
12
basics.
Items. Basic. 12 items, today's bill would cost about 564 rand, right? In 2050, the same 12 items will cost 3,742 rand.
Right? Wow.
12 items, for just 12 items. It's probably barely even full.
Yeah.
3,700 rand. I don't want to sound negative by talking about it. As I said, and you questioned me that we should rather understand inflation in order to beat it. That's the only way to beat it, to understand it. So towards that end, let me just end off by giving my contribution is to do the following two things. Number one, if a person is in fixed employment, the minimum they should ensure is that their salary is increasing on a year-to-year basis by at least the figure of official inflation. So if inflation for the year is currently in South Africa, say 5%, then the salary should be increased by a minimum of 5% each year. In this way, if this happens until 2050, inshallah, if the salary keeps on increasing at 5%, every consumer will be able to afford what is available in 2050 at whatever price. So if basically inflation is here to stay for as long as we have fiat currency, and for as long as we have money which is currently in vogue the way it is. This is why current fiat currency is such a problem, because it's a function of interest. Inflation is basically a function of interest. It's ingrained in every little thing, and I'm not going to go into the details for now. Be that as it may, the first thing to ensure to beat inflation is to make sure that the salary is at least increasing by 5%. The second thing and the last thing I want to contribute for this particular, for today only, is the aspect of saving at least between 3 to 5% more than inflation each year. So if a person is saving X amount in 2019. For 2020, their saving, the total saving should increase by another 3 to 5%. In this way, the savings over time will eventually be able to sustain oneself in time to come, and the individual will be able to afford whatever is on the market in 2050. So those are just two basic things that should be ensured to ensure that to kind of mitigate the effects of inflation over the long run. There are many, many other ways of doing it, but I won't go into all of them for now.
Okay, that's a very scary, for me, I just, you know, I'm not looking at myself, but I'm looking at the world in general, and we already see how, you know, people are battling to make it from paycheck to paycheck. That's if they even earn that, you know. There are so many people out there who don't, who are living off either grants and you know, pensions and that kind of thing. And to think that they may not be able to afford some of the basic requirements, we see it already today. You know, jokingly, walking through a supermarket aisle, I said to my daughter, you know what, I think I'll just buy us some dog food and I'll probably, you know, create a dish with it at home because I like to cook. And she gave me this look that basically I would have wilted if I wasn't a mother and knew her. But it's just scary to think that there are actually people out there who do buy dog food because they cannot afford anything else. And that's a, you know, something that they buy. And it's usually the very, very, you know, old people that are living on pensions. I've seen this working within the old age homes. You see people actually living off things like that. And the sad reality is, as you said, as long as we are following the system that we have at present, this is going to be the outcome every single time.
Every single time, yes.
Yeah.
I think what I don't want to bring our listeners down, rather provide some encouragement. So I'm concerned about what I've done in the past few minutes.
I think you're making us aware that we should start looking at saving and other ways to, you know, to make sure that we are prepared for this.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And the thing is, if you look at it from the past to now, so say the past 30 years to now, 30 years ago, people didn't think that they would be paying 12 rand for a loaf of bread. Right?
Yes.
But it's happening, and people are still living, and the world is changing. So, inshallah, we as Muslims, as economic units, we have a different kind of value system that should drive our behavior or understanding of commercial issues. We have a deeper meaning of who provides for us. So that is very unique, and the world is pining for it, and they're just not exposed to what value system we have. So
absolutely.
We will live and we'll carry on, inshallah, and our generation will thrive and survive and thrive. And we'll find a way around the current economic system which is prevailing over the world, and it will change. In time to come, inshallah.
Inshallah. Well, Mufti, Jazakallah Khair, we have to end for today because we've got a few other things that need to go through. We have to pay bills, so the adverts have to go through as well. And then we have news coming up. But Jazakallah Khair for your time. And inshallah, we'll speak to you again next week.
Inshallah. Amin. Jazakallah Khair.
Amin.